This is the Medicast, June 25th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 72. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this podcast. It's been a great week, rolling into the summertime full swing with my kids home from school, and we're off doing a lot of different summer chores and summer projects and summer fun stuff. But I'm back here again this week to bring another episode of the Medicast to you. If you're a brand new listener, welcome to the show. We're going to be covering a lot of fun stuff tonight. We're going to be looking at the dual lumen airway or the CombiTube, and we're also going to be looking at Narcan as the med of the week. So stay tuned. After the news, we'll get right into that. And of course, for all of those longtime listeners out there, I want to welcome you back to the Medicast. Thank you for all of your comments, all of your suggestions, all of your support for the show and support for each other, because this is a community effort here. And when I have something that I can't figure out on my own, I rely on you guys to send me links for information and share your experiences and your knowledge with the other listeners to the Medicast. In that way, we all become better EMS providers, and that is the goal when we listen to this show. At least I think it is. So without further ado, I guess it's time to jump into this week's listener email. I got quite a bit of email this week. I'll just touch on a few of them right now. I got an email from listener Foster, aka the Baby Medic from the Baby Medic blog, and he was checking in to apologize that he was away on vacation during the recent Medicast live recording over at TalkShoe. And if you haven't gotten a chance to check that out in the feed or haven't downloaded it yet, you can go over to the website and click on the Medicast Live category in the left-hand side. Or if you look in your feed on whatever RSS reader that you get stuff downloaded on, you'll see the most recent episode for the June Medicast Live. And that featured information on precepting. So there's a lot of great information there from several bloggers and podcasters and some people that are preceptors and people that are in the middle of being precepted. And we got a lot of great information shared about what's expected on both sides of that picture. So Foster, I appreciate you checking in with me. If you haven't checked out Foster's blog, you can head on over to the podcast site at medicast.com. And on the left-hand side, you'll see a link to all the different blogs and EMS sites that I recommend. And you'll find the Baby Medic blog there. He is a new medic. He's out there on the street getting precepted right now. And he shares some of his experiences, his thoughts, his trials and tribulations with the rest of us. And I think it's a great learning experience. And Foster, thank you for putting in the effort of doing that. And maybe we can get you here on the show here real soon. I got another email from listener David in Massachusetts, and David was commenting on some things he'd heard in a recent podcast that I'd done about the problems with air medical services and private air ambulance services in this country, and the challenges faced by our comrades that fly with those services when the dollar comes into play on whether it's safe to put the helicopter or the airplane in the air during certain weather conditions. And I know that not all services do this, but I think it is something that we need to focus on. Sometimes you'll hear that these helicopters inherently lose money, but when you look at the amount of money they bring into the hospitals they serve and the hospital systems that they serve, they actually bring in millions of dollars to the hospital themselves in billable fees. The patients, for one survey, for the University of Michigan Survival Flight Service in fiscal year 2001, according to David, had operating expenditures around $6 million, but they generated revenues of $62 million in patient fees for the University of Michigan Health System. And this is what I was talking about, that these helicopters bring in so much money that I wonder sometimes if the people at the top overlook the inherent danger of running such a service, except in the best of weather and in the best of conditions. So, David, thank you for sharing that with me. Please keep me up to date on anything that you come across. You seem to have a good pipeline for some great information there. And if any of you would like information on that particular study, I have it here. Just shoot me an email requesting the helicopter service study, and I'll be happy to send you the link that David sent me to that particular journal study. Zach Guidry over at the Your Studio A podcast, which is a podcast that's operated by the Acadian Ambulance Service, which serves a significant portion of the Louisiana, I believe, Alabama, Mississippi, and eastern Texas areas. And they do a great podcast where they talk about recent changes in their protocols, answer questions from medics in the field, and is a great example of podcasting within a corporate structure and the ability for podcasts to provide up-to-date training information for a group of people that are very scattered, which we are. You know, we're in single ambulances out on the street or running out of distant stations from the main infrastructure that we serve. And so it's hard for us to get together and train on a regular basis. And podcasting offers us the ability to all stay on the same page. And Your Studio A does a great job of that. And that information is out there for all of us to learn from. And I think that's great that they offer that service to the rest of the country. But Zach sent me some information. They got a chance to interview Dr. James Broslow, who is the inventor of the Broslow tape, the pediatric assessment tool. And they asked him a bunch of questions, including some questions about what to do with the recent increase in obesity in children. So check out the link I put up earlier this week, or head on over to the YourStudioA.com podcast, and you'll find a link in their site as well. And you can check out their great interview with Dr. Broslow. And Zach, thanks for sending me that link. Finally, I'd like to thank our great friend of the show, Chris Black. Chris has been very active on the site this week, putting up some comments in the different blog posts and also shooting me some emails about several different things. And Chris, I certainly appreciate all the time you put in sharing the things that you come across with me and the other listeners. And if any of you are not sure what I'm talking about, head over to the Medicast site at medicast.com, and you can check out all of the comments that get put up by all the listeners for the blog posts. And if you have comments to add of your own, please feel free to do so. You can click on the bottom of each of the posts, and you just have to create a login if you haven't done so already and put your comment up there, and it'll show up shortly thereafter on the site. So please check out the site and do that. It's the way for all of us to share information with each other. Chris also sent me some emails, and one of them had to do with a stand taken by several Canadian neurologists issuing a statement warning that chiropractic neck manipulation may be a significant cause of stroke and death in younger adults. And so this is something that's going to be, I think, a little bit of a he said, she said situation, because the Canadian Chiropractic Association has come back right away with a response that chiropractic manipulations are proven relievers of back pain, migraines, and other issues, and that they have a great safety record. So this is just something to look at. I'm going to probably gather together a great deal of this information. Chris sent me several different links. So look for something on that to be posted in the next week or so, and I'll be able to give you the links where you can go and make some of your decisions yourself. But it might be something to ask. One of the things that came up in the studies was that people weren't often asked if they'd recently had a chiropractic visit when they presented with a sudden aneurysm or a sudden stroke at a relatively young age, say in their 30s or 40s. And so this is something we might want to add to our list of health history questions, where we can get a better sense of what kind of things the patient has done and thereby pass that information on to the ED when we arrive, because they may not be asking these questions either. And this is something you can kind of pass on to the nurse. Hey, you know what? They had some recent chiropractic manipulation, and it may be may have something to do with their pain or something to do with their situation. And you just pass it along, let them deal with it. But at least you've taken the step of getting the ball rolling by asking the question in the first place. I'm not saying that there's a definite link there, but it certainly is a valid piece of patient history for any recent medical treatment. Okay, time for this week's news. I'll jump right in here with a story I found about giving back to the service, giving back to EMS, and how we can do that. And, you know, I do that in one way, and that is by putting out this podcast and creating the Medicast website. And there's lots of other great podcasts and blogs out there that deal with EMS, and that's one way of giving back. But all of us can give back by being mentors and or educators for EMS in our local communities and areas. And I found a great story that just talks about that and just gives us an idea from a provider in Texas on how he looks at getting out there and educating new EMTs and paramedics. And so it's a great story that talks about the drive he has to begin his career in EMS as an EMT, and eventually to move into becoming an instructor at the local community college to really get out there and be an EMS educator. And I think that is something that we all need to do, be EMS educators, EMS advocates in our services, whether it's officially as an official instructor or just as a mentor who can show people, hey, look, this is something I learned along the way, pass it on. You know, this is how we can encourage people to stick around and encourage people to feel good about their skills by sharing our skills with each other. So I think this is awesome, and I look forward to learning more about this type of thing in the future. But check out the link. It's a great article that talks all about one instructor's drive to become an EMS educator. The next item is just another difficult look at the lingering cloud over the 9/11 rescuers' fate after the fact. Many of the city's firefighters and emergency services personnel were covered by disability coverage provided by the city of New York. But a significant number of them, most of them EMS personnel who worked for private hospital-based ambulance services, who were called to the scene and involved in the rescue efforts there, and some of them trapped themselves, were not covered under the city's response to the 9/11 injuries. And so we have a huge number of people who heroically responded to a disaster in their community when they were called, who were cut off from benefits because of their own company's policies and because they were excluded from the city's policies. And I don't want to point blame at the private sector here, but there were a lot of, you know, New York City had money pouring in, and they were able to draw on some government funding to provide additional benefits to their firefighters and EMS providers who were on scene, police officers, Port Authority officers, the rest, who were all able to glean some benefit from the public funding that was out there in light of their ongoing respiratory issues following the efforts at 9/11. But the private sector people were not so lucky. And in many cases, when they began having disability problems, they were cut loose. And some of them were not employed long enough to qualify for disability. Their injuries were not recognized as related to 9/11 exposures at the scene to toxic dust and such. And so they were not given any kind of extra benefit. And after the fact, they are not able to apply back for it because it wasn't known about. They can't reapply after the fact in many cases. And so we have a lot of tragic situations out there where people's families are falling apart and they are just not getting the coverage they need. And I'll tell you, one of the most telling things we have in here is that if Bush can send $15 billion to Africa over 5 years for AIDS treatment, why can't we find $1 billion a year to help the people here at home who were involved in this heroic effort? So I urge you to check out the story. There's a lot of great links to different things in there dealing with 9/11 and the people responding and the ongoing problems they're having with their health. And I think you will be interested to find out more about this. And maybe this will drive you to contact your own congressmen and senators in Washington and urge them to get out there, darn it, and extend coverage. We know who these people are. We know who was at the scene. They were exposed to toxic dust at the scene. This has been proven. Scientists have gone in and looked at the substances trapped in these people's lungs. They can trace it directly back to the dust found at the Ground Zero site. So we know that these people sustain their injuries. These aren't people trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes and get something for nothing. And you know what? I think we need to pass along the message that, yeah, if they want us to go out there and endanger our lives and take away from our families' livelihoods on a daily basis and go out and risk ourselves to help out somebody in the public, then they better darn well show us that they're willing to recognize and help us or help our families after the fact. Because so many of us work for private services, or in my case, a volunteer for a company that is funded partly by the public, but is not an official part of a public agency. If we had some kind of a problem here, what would cover me? Would my family be covered? Would I get health coverage after the fact if I didn't claim workers' comp benefits within the first 24 hours? Well, I didn't know I was going to develop a debilitating lung illness a few months later based on the dust I inhaled. You know, and so guess what? I'm not covered because the laws don't protect me the same way. And my company is not going to go out there and spend, give me $1 million to cover my future health costs like many people got in the city of New York services. So we need to make sure that they understand what we expect in response to the effort and time and energy we put out there for the public. The next item I found had to do with an ambulance fire that I found reported that happened in West Virginia. A paramedic from Roanoke, Virginia, was in the ambulance transporting a patient when there was a report of a fire in the back. The patient they were transporting was not injured, but the paramedic in the back did sustain some severe burns to his arms and face as a result of the transport and the fire in the back. There is some evidence that the fire was caused by possibly an electrical short or some kind of electrical problem. However, we need to remember that this is an oxygen-rich environment in many cases. If we're flowing high-flow oxygen in the back of the ambulance and we're in the process of a long-term transport, we are creating an oxygen-rich environment, and any spark is more likely to catch fire if it's next to a flammable substance. And so it's something we need to be aware of. You know, turn off our oxygen bottles when they're not in use and disconnect our O2 from the patient if we don't need to be giving them O2 at that time. This is something that may or may not be related to this, but we have had problems with oxygen causing an increased risk of fire in the back of an ambulance in the past, and it's something we need to be aware of. So I urge you to just keep an eye on what's going on, check your maintenance records, make sure your units are being kept up to date. If you do have an issue that you suspect is a problem with some, you know, wiring or something in the back, get it checked out right away. Don't take a chance with it, because like I said, it wouldn't take much for something to catch fire when you're flowing oxygen in the back of an enclosed space. You're going to increase the likelihood that that fire will have fuel and oxygen to use to burn. Finally, this week, I found a study over at WebMD that talks about why men skip doctor's visits. Now, we all know this is true. I'm as guilty of it as anybody else is. But basically, men generally only go to the doctor when they are extremely sick, and usually at the behest of a loved one, spouse, or somebody else in their close personal family or close associates. And because of this, many men are missing out on routine survey type information, routine testing that could be done that could alleviate ongoing long-term health problems down the road. And this is something like tracking somebody who has problems with like pre-hypertension, or maybe somebody who is having some diabetes problems that if changed rapidly with diet or changing losing some weight may completely alleviate the need to go on any kind of diabetes medication or to be forced to be beholden to insulin for the rest of their lives. So this is something that's very interesting, not something that's surprising, but it is something that we can make a difference about in the field. When you have somebody that's being transported, maybe they're picked up on the job site because they're having, maybe they had an injury, or they're at home and you know, they had a fall and they're just going to the hospital to get checked out. When you're going down through their medical history, ask them the last time they went to their family primary care doctor. And also take a look at their vital signs. Are they running a little high on the blood pressure? Are they, you know, showing signs of some other things going on? You can point out to them that they really need to maybe go check with their primary care physician after the trip to the emergency room to get their ankle checked out or whatever their injury is. Urge them to go to their primary care physician. Say, you know what? When you get to be a certain age, you probably need to have a pretty regular physical checkup because so many things nowadays can be cured or successfully treated if somebody gets treated and recognized fast enough for whatever the issue may be. And you just let them know that, you know, say, hey, you know, your blood pressure is a little high. Maybe you ought to go just check in with your doctor. They can treat that pretty well now and give you some ideas on how to take care of that. And that will make the rest of your life very much more enjoyable, and you'll be able to have a longer, healthier life. So this is something we can all make a difference about in the field. Again, you know, we spend time in the back of the ambulance. We've done our initial survey for a priority 3 patient that doesn't require a lot of treatment, and we have some time to shoot the breeze with them. And we can use that time to become proponents of good healthcare practices. That'll wrap up the news, and that means it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. This week, I'm going to look at another one of the National Registry for EMT skill sheets. This week, the ALS skill sheet for the dual lumen airway. And so I want to give you an opportunity to follow along with me. This will be something you can play out for yourself over and over again. And if you're in the process of getting ready to test, and it'll give you an opportunity to listen to somebody talk you through the process while you're driving along, or maybe you're, you know, shaving in the morning or whatever it is, you can practice in your mind and visualize what you're doing. This won't take the place of you actually getting out there and playing with a combi tube or a dual lumen airway of another variety, but it will give you some memory to back up your muscle memory that you're going to use while you practice. So this is just another way to succeed, and athletes use it all the time. They visualize and talk themselves through successful situations, and that's what I'm going to do for you right now, is talk you through the skill sheet. There's a link in the show notes, so you can actually go and download the skill sheet for yourself over at the National Registry site. You can dig around over there. There's all kinds of information about testing situations, about how the tests are derived, what kind of information you might expect to find, as well as all of the skill sheets for all the stations. They don't have the actual scenarios for the verbal scenarios, but they do have the skill sheets that you're going to need to check off, and it'll give you some insight on what the preceptor for that station is looking for. And so without further ado, let's jump right on in. First off, when you walk into the room, you will be asked to take a look at the equipment and familiarize yourself with it. Again, make sure you check everything out. Make sure everything's there. You inflate your cuffs on the combi tube or the dual lumen airway, depending on which one they're using. And you're going to make sure that everything's in proper working order, that the airway mannequin that they're using, that there's lubrication present for the tube. If they tell you you don't need to use lubrication, you get them to write that down right then on the sheet that you asked for lubrication and they denied it. Because I did not pass my combi tube the first time around because I knew the airway mannequin that they were using was sticky. And if you didn't lube up the tube, it got stuck on the tongue. And if the tongue folded down, you couldn't get it in. And I did not get the patient tubed and bagged again in appropriate time frame. And I ended up failing the station and had to come back and retest it. So it's something for you to be aware of, that you do have, you know, you have the right to check your equipment and make sure it's appropriately prepared for you. And if they have some reason they don't want to do that, they say it's already lubricated, and it may be, That's okay, but you have them write that, say, please write that down on my check sheet that I asked you that and you said it was fine. Because you know what? At least you've covered yourself and you can say, you know what? I asked for lubrication. The tube got stuck when it went in. These airway mannequins are never properly lubricated if that's your particular issue. So just that's my own pet peeve to make sure that the equipment is together for you. The other advantage to checking your equipment when you walk in the room, you can then put your equipment back on the table in the order that you would use it. It's a nice little trick, but it's something you can do. So you know you're going to need your bag valve mask. You know you got an oxygen reservoir to hook up. So when you do that, make sure the tubing's attached to the bag valve mask. Make sure the tubing's laying next to the oxygen cylinder. Make sure the oxygen cylinder works, and then you move on down the line with your combi tube. You have your two syringes already set up. You kind of just make, it'll help you remember the steps, and you lay it out in order, and it's all right there when you go to grab it. So without further ado, let's jump right in. After you've checked out your equipment, you're going to go ahead and say you're ready to begin. The first thing you're going to do is make sure you take and or verbalize body substance isolation precautions. I recommend wearing gloves all day. I've told you this many times. It saved my butt on one of my stations because I was so nervous I forgot to say scene safety BSI. And the guy said, well, you know, you're wearing gloves, so you were thinking about it. Well, I wasn't thinking about it, but I'd put gloves on at 8 o'clock that morning. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when my brain was totally fried, me wearing gloves all day saved my butt. So that's something to keep in mind. You're then going to open the airway manually using a head tilt chin lift, elevate the tongue, and you're going to want to insert an airway adjunct, either an oropharyngeal or nasopharyngeal airway. You will be informed that the candidate has no gag reflex and the patient accepts whichever adjunct you use. Just make sure you measure it appropriately before you insert it. You're going to then ventilate the patient immediately with the bag valve mask device unattached to oxygen. And you will ventilate the patient with room air. Okay, they're going to ask you how much you're ventilating the patient, and you're going to say you're going to ventilate the patient at a rate of about 20 ventilations per minute using the bag valve mask. You will attach the oxygen reservoir to the bag valve mask device and connect it to a high flow oxygen source and continue bagging the patient. Again, anywhere between the rate of 10 to 20 per minute with the appropriate volume of the bag. After some time, you will be informed that the patient is being ventilated well without difficulty, and the examiner will auscultate and report that breath sounds are present and equal bilaterally with your ventilations using the bag valve mask, and that medical control has ordered the insertion of a dual lumen airway. The examiner will now take over ventilations as your BLS helper. You will direct your new assistant to pre-oxygenate the patient, ventilating them at about 20 per minute with 100% oxygen. You will then prepare and check out your airway device again, get everything ready. You will lubricate the distal tip of the device. You may verbalize this if it's already been lubricated or you've been instructed that it's taken care of. At your direction, the instructor slash assistant will remove the oropharyngeal or nasopharyngeal device and move out of the way with the bag valve mask when you tell them you're ready to go. You will position the head properly, perform a tongue-jaw lift, and you will insert the device, and I'm going to use combi tube here as my example, insert the device midline to the depth where the printed ring is at the level of the teeth. You will inflate the pharyngeal cuff, which is the big cuff, with 85 mLs of air, remove the syringe. You will then inflate the distal cuff, the smaller cuff, with about 10 mLs of air and remove the syringe. You will then rapidly direct or attach yourself the bag valve mask to the tube and ventilate the patient. Now you're going to attach it to the first tube first, the taller tube. You will then listen and confirm placement and ventilation of the lungs. If you do not hear breath sounds in that tube, you would then switch to the other tube and check there. Again, this is checking to see what's going on. You'll confirm placement bilaterally by listening. The instructor, after the first tube is checked, will say you do not see rise and fall of the chest. You only hear sounds over the epigastrium. You will then attach the BVM to the second smaller tube, shorter tube, and ventilate the patient there, confirming placement and ventilation by observing chest rise, auscultation over the epigastrium, and bilaterally over each lung. The examiner will now confirm adequate chest rise and absent sounds over the epigastrium and equal and bilateral breath sounds over the lungs. You will now secure the device and confirm that the device remains properly secured at all times. This is the end of this particular scenario. However, there are several failure critical criteria that fall in place here, and we're going to go over them just so you keep them in the back of your mind while you're practicing for this. You have 30 seconds from the beginning of the scenario to initiate ventilations after taking proper BSI precautions, and you may not interrupt your ventilations for more than 30 seconds at any time. So this is important to be aware of. Keep track of that when you move in. Now, if you've checked out your equipment and laid it out the way I've told you to, you shouldn't have too many problems. Again, I urge you to hook up the oxygen right away, because you can hook up an oxygen tank to a bag valve mask that's sitting right next to it and turn it on before 30 seconds have passed and go ahead and get that patient ready to be bagged. However, do this in your own way. If you'd rather start bagging them first and then stop for a few seconds to hook up the oxygen later, that's fine. Just do not fail to hook up oxygen to the patient. If you fail to take BSI or scene safety precautions, if you fail to voice or ultimately provide high concentration O2, if you fail to ventilate the patient with a rate of at least 10 per minute, if you fail to provide adequate volumes per breath. So again, you need to properly ventilate the patient, getting a good seal with the bag valve mask. If you don't pre-oxygenate the patient, that is, give them some breaths at the rate of about 20 per minute to make sure that the patient is properly ventilated, you can be failed. You can also be failed if you fail to insert the dual lumen airway device at a proper depth or at the proper place within 3 attempts. If you fail to inflate both cuffs with the proper volume. And with the combi tube, if you fail to remove the syringe immediately after inflation of the cuff, again, this is something to do. And with the other types of airways, there are failure devices as well for them. Failure to confirm that the proper lumen of the device is being ventilated by observing chest rise, auscultation over the epigastrium, and bilaterally over the lungs. And if you insert an adjunct in any manner that's dangerous to the patient. Again, measure your airway adjuncts there at the beginning before you insert them. You can do that just by examining them. Generally, if you're not the first person to go, you'll find that the proper sized one is usually sitting closer to the patient than the other ones in the box, or maybe is just tossed on top. Again, if this is an airway mannequin you're familiar with, you probably know about what size they take anyway. Again, all these things can help you out and will certainly make you a better prepared person for your testing situation. You can download this sheet and look at it yourself. I urge you to do so. I also included a link in the show notes to a study by an anesthesiologist on the combi tube. The first part of that study goes over exactly how the combi tube is supposed to be inserted, and there's some interesting pictures of the combi tube inserted, as well as drawings of the proper procedure. So I urge you to check that out as well. That's the tip and trick of the week, and that means that it's time to move on to this week's Med of the Week. This week, I'm looking at the drug Narcan, also known as naloxone, and this is a med that we use frequently enough, probably more frequently than we would care to, but it is an important med in our bag of tricks and something that we need to know a little bit more about. I have a link in the show notes to a site over at drugs.com on Narcan. You can also do a Google search to find other information on the medication. I'll be going under the Maryland protocol sheet, so that's what I'll be using to kind of go down through this list for Narcan here. You want to make sure you check out your own protocols so that you understand how your service uses this medication. Your doses may be higher or lower based on what your service medical director allows. So make sure you check in with your own protocols on Narcan. But generally, the medication should be very similar to what I'm going to be talking about here. Narcan is a drug that reverses all effects due to opioid agents. This drug will reverse the respiratory depression and all central and peripheral nervous system effects. It's important to understand that this does not just delay them, it reverses them. So if you have somebody who is high and is in respiratory depression and you give them Narcan, if you give them a lot of Narcan fast, they're going to be in a sudden state of withdrawal. So it's something to be aware of, that this will actually just shut it off like a light switch when this medication gets into the bloodstream and starts taking effect. And you may have a very unhappy or very sick person who has a drug addiction problem, and now they're in withdrawal. They could be vomiting. They could become violent. So keep this in mind. This is a medication without a lot of physical side effects from the drug itself, but it can have side effects from the actions that the drug has over the opioids that it counteracts. The onset of action with Narcan when administered by IV push is within a few minutes. It can also be administered intramuscularly or down an endotracheal tube, but it will have a slower onset of action. Patients that respond to naloxone may require additional doses and transportation to the hospital, since most of the medications and drugs that they're taking, the opioids, will last longer than the half-life of Narcan. So you've created a situation where you've rescued them, but they could easily slip back into an overdose situation as the Narcan begins to wear off after a short period of time. There is no effect of Narcan in the absence of narcotics. You know, this is where you get the guy that says, well, I haven't taken any narcotics. And you know darn well that the only thing Narcan works on is narcotics. There is no other effect that this drug has. The indications for narcotics, for the use of naloxone, is a suspected narcotics overdose. And you're doing this to reverse respiratory and central nervous system depression induced by opiate medications. There are no contraindications, significant contraindications for the use of naloxone or Narcan. Again, this is a medication. It's really a rescue drug. You're using it in an emergent situation, and you're not likely to know whether this person has a hypersensitivity to the drug. But in any case, they need to have the medication. You can always treat a hypersensitivity with your other medications you have in your bag of tricks, but you can't support somebody who's having a drug issue. Although you can ventilate them with good BLS ventilation skills, but that ties you and another provider up. And if you do have the ability to give Narcan, I urge you to do so. Now, again, if you know that they're hypersensitive, you probably need to call medical control and find out exactly what they want to do about it, but you're likely to get an order to go ahead and give a smaller dose of it anyway. There are no significant adverse effects for Narcan. Precautions you want to take, again, as I said earlier, Narcan may induce opiate withdrawal in patients, especially those who are physically dependent and addicted to the drug. Certain drugs that they take may require high dose of naloxone or Narcan to reverse than you might normally expect. This has been something we've seen cropping up when we've had people that are getting morphine cut with fentanyl or other high dose opioids, and they take something that's maybe from a different supplier and get a higher dose than they're expecting that's cut with a different medication. Again, be prepared with follow-up doses of Narcan as needed. Follow your protocols for that as well. Also, remember that you need to make sure that this drug is administered and titrated so that respiratory efforts return, but maybe not enough to give full consciousness. This is a little bit of a trick of the trade, but it's something to consider. If you have a person that's in the process of a drug overdose, you want to monitor their respiratory rate and see if you can give them Narcan in smaller doses a little bit at a time and see if you can get them to come back to a point where they're supporting their own respiratory system. They're ventilating themselves adequately, but are not going to wake up to the point that they start taking a swing at everybody. And again, this is a trick you're going to have to kind of have a feel for yourself and also follow in your own protocols, because you may be required to give a certain minimum dose. Generally, what I tend to use in Maryland here is our minimum dose is 0.4 milligrams up to 2 milligrams. And I tend to, you know, give 0.4, slow IV push, see what we've got, maybe give a little bit more, a few, 3, 4, 5 minutes later, see what we've got, and try to see what's going on. Again, if you're really not getting any response at all, you may need to give higher doses. Again, remember, you can support a patient who is unable to ventilate themselves by ventilating for them with good BLS ventilation skills while you see if the Narcan is going to work. Your dosage is going to vary by your protocol, but in Maryland, we have a 0.4 to 2 milligram IV, IM, or intranasal device usage. Also, you can give a 1 to 5 milligram dose via ET tube if necessary, if that's your only route of administration. Here we have intranasal devices that kind of create a mist spray. We put it up in the nostril and spray up through that with our syringe, and it actually mists into the mucosa. It's a little slower to be absorbed that way, but you don't have to be fighting trying to find the line in a difficult situation. You can administer the Narcan by that route. And see what happens. But you have a little less control over the absorption, and it's a little slower than IV push. Pediatric dosing for Narcan is 0.1 milligrams per kilogram IV push, IM, or intranasal, and up to a maximum initial dose of 2 milligrams, and it may be repeated as necessary to maintain respiratory activity. The endotracheal tube dose is going to be 0.2 to 0.25 milligrams per kilogram, and you want to check with your medical direction if you have any questions about pediatric patients. Anything greater in Maryland than 2 milligrams IV push needs to be done only with medical consultation. And that's going to be this week's Med of the Week, Narcan or Naloxone, and you can check out the link in the show notes if you want any further information on that medication. And that's going to wrap up this week's show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the Medicast and sharing the Medicast with all your friends and supporting the show in all of the great ways you do so. If you want to get back in touch with me, you can reach me here at the Medicast by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me by the Medicast voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And of course, you can always leave comments over at the MedicCast website at MedicCast.com. And you can check out each of the postings I put up during the week. I generally put up between 4 or 5, maybe even 6 different things a week of information, EMS news, links to interesting stories that I find. And all of that can be available to you by checking out the website at MedicCast.com. Of course, all of the links from tonight's episode are there as well in the show notes for today, and you can reach any of the information there that you need. If you need any further information, don't hesitate to email me. Keep in touch with me, and if you have any comments, corrections, or anything else you'd like to share about the show, don't hesitate to do so. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This is from an artist and a song that I've actually played before, but it's been about a year, so I think it's time to bring it out of the closet again. It's one of my favorite songs, something my kids really enjoy, an artist that my daughters enjoy a great deal, an artist by the name of Caitlin Smith. This is her song, Breathe Deep. And I think it's strangely appropriate for a week when we cover the Combi Tube that we have a song called Breathe Deep. So if you check out the song, enjoy it, and want to head on over to Caitlin's site, there's a link in the show notes. Let her know you heard the song here on the Medicast. And really, at the very least, keep in touch with the artists. Let them know that you heard their song on a podcast. Thank them for sharing their excellent music with podcasters. This is a great way for everyone to win. The artist wins by getting their music out there. The podcasters win by having great services and entertainment to provide to their listeners. And you, the listener, win because you get to hear songs and music that you wouldn't be able to hear ordinarily, because this great music is not always or often available on your local radio station or in your local record store. So check it out. If you like her music a whole lot, you can head on over to a link I have on the site for the iTunes store, and you can purchase her music directly in that way. And I guess that's it. I'm not going to talk anymore. I'll let the music wrap up the show. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.